Simon Torracinto, welcome to KBOO in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Today, Simon Torracinto and I will be discussing consumption, consumerism, how in capitalist societies, especially this one, we are urged and seduced in media and popular culture by many industries and pressure from our social groups to gain happiness and fulfillment in consumption. And do we consume? That is, the people that can afford it. And many others actually go deeply into debt. If this continues, we could wind up on an uninhabitable planet. Our human experiment ended by global warming. Simon and I talk about that also. And finally, we discuss how we can reconstruct this country, stop global warming, and do a lot of other wonderful things, work less, get involved in human relations and activities that produce enduring happiness and fulfillment. I learned of Simon Torracinto. He's finishing a PhD at Yale. I wanted to talk to him after reading his review of a book by Kate Soper titled A Low-Carbon Good Life for an Alternative Hedonism. That title, the hedonism, does not mean abandonment of everything but the search for pure pleasure, but rather it means the happiness and fulfillment of a good life. His review for me demonstrated a depth of knowledge and a generous thoughtfulness on issues of capitalism and consumerism and climate change and the complexity of popular consciousness. So, Simon, tell us about the various critiques of consumption and the consumer society. There's a lot of them.
So there are much more longstanding critiques of consumerism that go back at least since the beginning of mass consumer society itself, so from the 40s and the 50s. And, you know, the sort of most obvious critique that lives on is that became most prominent in the 60s that we associate with intellectuals like Herbert Marcuse, was this idea that capitalist society was creating these false needs, that through advertising and through other modes of indirect social control, that people were being forced to consume or sort of seducing to consumption, and that was distracting them from the sort of exploitation that they were experiencing. But what I was interested about with Kate Soper's book that I was reviewing is she puts a new twist on those older critiques. I think, you know, one thing that's particularly interesting about our contemporary period is that it's becoming increasingly clear that consumption, whatever we make of that older critique, is also unsustainable for very different green, ecological, or biophysical reasons, right? So these days, much of the attention of decarbonization is devoted to things like greening the grid, to alternative modes of electricity generation, like wind and solar, to electric cars. But decarbonization, so the, you know, reduction of our carbon emissions at the scale that we need, is going to require a much more fundamental social transformation than that. And the problem is that many patterns of consumption in rich countries, especially the United States, think of flying, meat consumption, et cetera, are very highly carbon intensive in themselves, or they require such amounts of energy that even if we did switch to green power generation, they'd require very damaging amounts of land and resource use, and they would lead to more deforestation or extraction. So just to take one example of that, you know, the news has been abuzz lately with a push for electric cars, but, you know, electric car batteries require rare earth minerals like lithium, and we can't really swap out every private vehicle in the world with an electric one. That would require huge amounts of lithium that we aren't sure we have, and that would also lead to huge amounts of extraction mining, especially in the global south. So that really brings a new perspective to older critiques of consumption, which is whether or not it's good for us, it's bad for the planet. And very fundamental changes in our patterns of consumption will have to follow if we want to fully decarbonize our economy.
In Kate Soper's book, you went into another critique, which is very important. That is a popular critique. There are so many ways that people, even as they're consuming, deal with it sardonically. There's a self-critique of consumerism that people use. Let's say the shop till you drop. Well, most people use that sardonically. They don't really want to shop. They know it isn't what they really want to be doing. And yet it's sort of diverting and distracting, and they do it with friends. So they refer to, we're going out to shop while you drop. Or there's clothing rebels, you know, and people who dress up in costumes the way we used to in the 60s. I was from a middle-class family, and I used to wear blue work shirts. Well, and of course, the fashion industry co-opts all of that. And there are action critiques you talked about, like interest in crafts, a lot of action critiques, growing disillusion with automobiles, more biking. Tell us about that.
I think what is particularly interesting about Sofa's work and, you know, what I found productive was that she identifies all these movements in society as it is that seem to suggest a kind of popular discontent with the idea of the good life that we're told, you know, on Super Bowl TV ads or through advertising or any other standard message is what we ought to want. And so she looks at things like the turn to craft, attempts to reuse and recycle, the slow food movement, the sort of clamor for increasing access to green space, the new urbanism, right, that focuses on walking and biking at the expense of cars. And she sees in that not necessarily an explicit political commitment, but a kind of more implicit, more low-level dissatisfaction, right, a register of dissatisfaction with the good life of high consumption. And she sees in that the seeds of a more radical transformation and one that we would need to make and may even want to make if we want to live in a decarbonized and perhaps even more pleasurable society than the one we have now.
You know, I remember reading, I can't find the citation, a study of janitors who are on the cleanup crew of big buildings with marble floors. And the janitors, I mean, they had to do the work and make enough to feed their family. But they did the work in ways where the water spreading machines and then the drying machines, they would leave streaks. And the janitors sort of competed making art with their machines. So the streaks at some point for a minute before it dries out, the streaks were some sort of transient art. And I think that's an effort to take what people would consider the worst kind of work and make it into both a game and a art project. There's more going on in even people at the lower rungs. And yeah, comment.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this speaks to this broader question of hedonism, right, that is raised by this question of consumption and in Sofa's book, which is that people have a need for forms of pleasure, but those forms of pleasure don't necessarily have to come through conventional forms of consumption of fixed goods, right? So things like cars or clothes or whatever, that there can be forms of pleasure that come from much deeper needs for meaning, for kinship, for being with others, for being outside, and for also for forms of art and forms of craft. And I think the anecdote about the janitors is a sort of emphatic example of that, right? That even in work that many of us would think of as potentially judgerous, clearly there's a need for a form of art making, right, in the form of self-expression. And as we think about this broader question of pleasure as it relates to climate change, we can think about the forms of mass public luxury and consumption that aren't carbon intensive, but that nevertheless make our lives meaningful and happy. And I think Sofa is very compelling on this idea that a greener world doesn't necessarily have to be a pleasureless or austere world.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Simon Carasenta. He is doing a PhD in history. He wrote a really interesting book review on consumerism and the possibilities of a radical alternative to finding pleasure and fulfillment. We discussed the critiques of consumerism. For one, the capitalist drive for growth and increased consumption has generated climate change. We've also discussed the growing popular critique of increasing numbers of people trying to find pleasure in creative activities and crafts and reading and writing groups, even in alternative religious groups that are far more democratic. But if people are trying to exit the system, if they are at least beginning to see it, are in fact succeeding in exiting the system to some extent, and if they are beginning to see the need to stop growth and consumption and reduce climate change to manageable levels, ultimately restore the ecosystem upon which life depends, but they also fear the radical changes that are necessary. So however attractive, however much they carve out spheres of life outside of the market and market consumption, today the great majority, in my sense, would be hesitant to take seriously our alternative. After all, they need to keep working, earning income, changing most everything, including all of industry and how they operate and what they make, and some industries disappearing. That creates anxiety, and people become even more precarious than they are now, which requires us to think about what can be done now to prepare the way for the great mobilization to make all of the necessary changes. First, Simon Torrescent, right now people are not ready to make the radical changes that are necessary. They do have a stake in the system. Tell us more about that and why now they aren't ready to join the revolution. And then we can conclude with what we can do now that would change their minds, that would contribute at least to changing their minds as the situation grows more dire and decisions have to be made.
I think a lot of people right now, whether they like it or not, are in some sense trapped or forced into patterns of intensive consumption of one kind or another, partly because of the built environment and the infrastructure that we have, the sprawling suburbs, right, of detached houses that are heated on their own, et cetera, and lack of access to transportation, that sort of thing. But on the other hand, also by the arrangements of our society where most people have to work all the time or nearly all the time in order to survive. So I think both of those things, the infrastructure and the nature of making a living, would have to change in order for people to be able to make the kinds of transition that we're talking about. So that would require, I think, very different modes of social policy. People's needs would have to be met in at least partially in other ways. And for me, that's why things like a fight for single-payer healthcare or the decommodification of housing or free education, even if on the face of it they don't seem like they're really about climate change, they're actually, for me, very fundamental to that question, because people will only be prepared to make a radical transformation in their life if their basic needs are met, if they feel secure enough to do that, and also if the built environment and infrastructure around them facilitates that. You can't choose to start taking the bus to work, for instance, if there is no bus line servicing your neighborhood, right? And so these things would have to change in order for people to be able to make any change at all. And so some of the ideas that Soper talks about in the book are especially around the question of the drastic reduction of working hours. So at the moment, there's a kind of work and then spend treadmill, right? Part of the reason that we consume so much is that we work so much and we don't have the time to use our leisure in freer ways, right? We only have a few hours off here and there, and then that gets concentrated in carbon-intensive forms of consumption. But we can imagine a very different society in which we worked far less and we had much more time to devote to things like care work, right, or caring for ourselves or for relatives, to devote to education, to the arts, to nature, and all these things, you know, aren't very resource intensive at all, but they often provide more enduring and fundamental forms of satisfaction. But in order for people to want that, that would already need to be a reality somewhere. And so for me, I think the vision is building real places, be they cities or elsewhere, that start to construct this kind of alternative society that in some sense would be a proof of concept. Of course, the problem with climate change is that emissions anywhere cause a problem for everywhere. So eventually there would have to be a more broad global transition. But I think the starting point can be local. And I think constructing something in one place can be a model for everywhere else.
You've already brought us to the final issue today, how to advance our alternative, what is to be done to save the planet and let people lead the lives that they yearn for with all the consumer goods they need and more time for really fulfilling activities. Seems to me we have to distribute our wealth also a whole lot better. Every job should be a living wage job and secure. Precariousness also is one of the reasons people are so afraid to defy the boss. Before this interview, I asked you about my hypothesis, whether you might want to reply to it. I think you accepted. Anyway, let me state a hypothesis about what has to be done. You've already, in fact, pointed some of the things out. That is, climate disasters are going to become more frequent and damaging and dangerous. People are certainly going to recognize that threat and demand action. So if starting today we begin to demonstrate the superiority of our alternative, partly by talking about our alternative and its feasibility, and partly by creating those model cities and model programs that you discuss. Some now, though, the cities are actually operating on the way to 100% renewable energy, but mostly operating on the technological side. But it's not beyond the realm of possibilities that people would ultimately choose us over the emerging capitalist alternative, which relies on new unproven technologies like safe nukes, carbon capture, sequestration, hydrogen energy. None of them, there's been a lot of research in all of them, and none of them are solutions. And they're being proposed by those elites who have been actually delegitimated by their years of inaction and profit-seeking uberalis and their climate change denial. Simon, I gather you find that that way of looking at it, that when people get roused out of their fear of upsetting the apple cart and losing work, that there's a far greater threat to them and their children, that they'll be, if we do our work now in legitimating that transformation that we need, we could in fact prevail. At least there's a chance.
Yes, I think that sounds very plausible to me, and I think it's a cause for hope. What I would say and what I would stress is that I think that the rising fear that is undoubtedly going to come as climate disaster gets worse, as wildfires get stronger, as extreme weather continues, that we urgently need to figure out a way to channel the feelings that are going to come out of that into productive political expression. At the moment, so much of the mantra that we hear when it comes to climate change is doing our part in this highly individualistic way. Recycle more, shop less, you know, drive less, etc. And those are all good messages, but individualizing the problem is also a way of removing responsibility from broader social structures and from bad actors, be they corporate or government. And I think channeling that energy and that dissatisfaction that we spoke about earlier into avenues of remaking society now will make it more likely that we will have those viable models in the future when things get increasingly dire and we have something to point to. So what I would say as well is I think we need to convince or show people who are already fighting for their livelihoods, you know, teachers striking for a living wage, people fighting for public housing in cities or for access to green space, that their fight is actually part of a broader fight that's connected to climate change and the question of decarbonization, and that the more we can win as these kinds of public goods, the more we unlock these forms of public leisure and public consumption that give us an alternative vision of the good life that can replace the damaging one that we have at the moment. So I think it's partly about showing a viable alternative and partly about connecting a lot of existing energy and existing political mobilization that's already happening.
Yeah, one final thing. Not only are we told to turn off our lights at night and all of these sort of individual drive less, drive an electric car, even a Tesla, which requires so much in the construction of it and the mining for it and all the rest that it cancels out any good it would do. We hear that. We also hear from our comrades a great emphasis, it seems to me, now and for the last several years on defeating and stopping the fossil fuel industry. And I think that's a good idea. I mean, that's absolutely necessary, and they've done really good work. But I think they have to pivot a lot more towards building and promoting our alternative that we have one that it's feasible and that we can live much better. You get the last word, Simon Torricento.
I agree, and I actually think there are two sides of the same coin. I think we can build power by building forms of alternatives, by creating an alternative good life. And that actually gives us the political capacity to fight back against fossil fuel. And I think, you know, if we can walk and chew gum, we'll be in a good place.
Simon Torricento, very good talking to you. If you want to read more, I recommend his most excellent review of the Kate Soper book in the New Labor Forum. And he's also published in the Boston Review and the journal N+1. Simon, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's been a pleasure.